We thought today we would slightly change the tone of what we do and what we're talking about again. And we would look at the financial side, which is something we haven't always done, perhaps as fully as we should have done. And today we're going to be looking at really the effects of what happened in the 2008 financial collapse and thereafter. And we're very lucky that we have as a speaker Martin Wolf, who was the Associate Editor and Chief Economics Commentator of the Financial Times London. He is a CBE, which he was awarded for services to financial journalism. He was a member of the UK Government's Independent Commission on Banking between June 2010 and September 2011. And I've got an enormous long biography, which I won't read. But I think the most important thing is he won the Overseas Press Club of America's prize for best commentary on international news in any medium for 2013, and he's had a number of recent publications, Why Globalization Works, but the latest one, The Shifts and the Shocks, What We've Learned and Have Still to Learn from the Financial Crisis, is the one about which he will be talking today, and there are copies of the book on sale at the back, if you want to get one on your way out, and I hope you'll take advantage of that. But I think we're very lucky to have Martin Wolf here today, and I'll ask him to speak to us.
So, first, thank you very much for the invitation. This is remarkably high for me, but I hope you can see me just about on, over the top. The disadvantage of not being very tall. There aren't that many, at least not by my age, but this is one. So I'm very pleased to be speaking to you. And does this thing work, does it? Well, we'll see what happens. It's right. Exciting. Technology. It's a really sophisticated technology. So I'm very pleased to be here to talk to you about my book and what the implications of this crisis. I will be happy, though I have to run away probably by 2:15. I have a column to finish today. But fortunately, the draft is done, so I'm not too pressed. I'm very happy to talk about the book and its implications. I think I suspect most of you here are predominantly interested in international security and foreign policy issues, but I hope I really don't need to persuade you after the events of at least of the last 10 years that economics and economic crises and financial crises have a great deal of bearing on the things that you're concerned about. For a very long time, I've been giving lectures almost on an annual basis, the Royal College of Defence Studies, to military people, and mainly, almost entirely, not exclusively military people. And my lecture always starts by saying why economics is the most important single thing that military strategists should be thinking about. It's the ultimate determinant of everything in the modern world. And I think the crisis is a pretty clear demonstration of this. Unfortunately, the crisis also shows, and I'll come to this in a moment, the failures and failings of my profession. I was an economist before I became a journalist. And I'm going to start with before I explain what I'm going to talk about, I think, a very apposite quote, which I discovered when I was looking into depressions. And I think the quote comes from the 30s, but I haven't yet found out whose quote it was. Anyway, the quote is, such a severe depression and banking crisis could not have been achieved by normal civil servants and politicians. It required active economists' involvement. And I think that is true in this case, unfortunately. So I'm going to ask a series of questions, as I'm prone to do. I'm going to ask why you should care about the crisis, why it happened, what have we done with it, what should be done, and finally, briefly, obviously all this I'm going to cover very quickly, what are some of the geopolitical consequences, what are some of the things that are of interest to you? Because I believe that in a number of respects, this has changed our world from the world we thought we were in 10 or 15 years ago. So why should you care? It seems sort of pretty obvious, but let me just remind you. The crises, which became obvious in 2007 and 2008 and are still ongoing, particularly in the Eurozone, it's pretty obvious, it's not yet emerged from crisis conditions. And even in the US and UK, there's one very clear indicator, that we're not back to normal or anything that we would regard as normal, which is you just have to look at the monetary policy of our central banks. As I've said many, many times, as long as they continue to supply money to their banks, they're prepared to lend to their banks at zero interest rates, we are very, very far from a normal economic situation. That is really very, very obvious. And we've now been in this essentially free money situation for 6 years, pretty well now for 6 years in the developed world. The ECB resisted, but is now there too. So there is now no central bank. The four major central banks of the developed world, which lends to the banking sector at more than 0.5%. And this niggardly central bank that lends at 0.5% is ours, the Bank of England. All the others are below. And I'm not even talking about the balance sheet expansion, so I won't have time to go into them and their implications. Perhaps we can discuss that in questions. And just to put this in context, and it's particularly interesting in the case of the UK, because the Bank of England is very old. It's, I think, the second oldest central bank in the world. We have data on bank rate, as it used to be called, and now base rate, going back to the late 17th century. And over that entire period, prior to this crisis, the Bank of England never lent at less than 2%. So this is a genuinely different world. Obviously, in crisis circumstances, world wars, several financial arrangements were rather peculiar, but that was the norm. So this is an extraordinary crisis, and we're still in it. We're still in it, very, very clearly. It has had very, very large economic consequences. Without going into the details of how far the shortfalls in GDP I'm going to discuss relative to trend were due to the way we handled the crisis, due to the crisis, or due to what the debt increases before the crisis masked. These are three possibilities. We all have now, in the developed world, without exception, economies that are extraordinarily much smaller than anyone imagined in, say, 2005 or 2006. And roughly speaking, it varies, but for the major economies, in the UK case, the economy is now about 18% smaller than if the pre-crisis trends had continued. In the US, it's much the same. In the Eurozone as a whole, it's about 15% smaller, mainly because the pre-crisis trend was so weak, and I'm not even going to talk about Italy. So The losses are extraordinarily large, and at the moment, the UK is the only economy to have regained pre-crisis growth rates, and no economy, and I mean none, has regained pre-crisis rates of growth and productivity. So it's as we are now, we are permanently poorer in a very big way than we thought we would be at this point in 2005 or 2006. And one of the consequences of that, which is pretty obvious from last week, is we all have, to a greater or lesser degree, fiscal problems, which are really just about how we share out these losses. Who bears the consequences? How do we distribute the consequences of these losses? And the final reason why I think this crisis is incredibly important is, of course, it wasn't expected. Now, I mean by this something quite precise or relatively precise, and I'm talking about economists and economic policymakers, so the dominant thinkers about this sort of stuff in treasuries, central banks, IMF, OECD, the Financial Times, and so forth, and academics. And what I mean by this is something relatively precise. I don't mean by that that they failed to forecast that a crisis like this would start in the summer of 2007. I don't think this is a crisis of this crisis. Financial crises are forecastable in that sense. And if they were in that precise sense, it's pretty clear we will behave in such a way as to prevent them. The problem is not that they weren't forecast. The problem was and is that to these policymakers, a crisis of this scale, and I don't have the time to go into all that, but I could discuss it, was inconceivable. That's a much more important failure. It's like living on a earthquake fault and being shocked that there was, you know, living on the San Andreas fault and actually being shocked that there was an earthquake. We know that there's going to be an earthquake on the San Andreas fault, even if you can't forecast precisely when it happens. And we didn't know. We didn't know. And while I was pretty clear that the trends we had before the crisis couldn't continue, I wrote about that, I certainly didn't expect essentially the dissolution of the financial sector. And I think it's important to understand, my very last comment on this, that in September and October 2008, the core financial sector, the core financial system of the Western world essentially fell to pieces. It required the comprehensive backing of our states and central banks to keep it together and to restore confidence. It was a staggeringly wide-ranging and significant panic. So the second question I want to address is, why on earth did this happen? That's a core part of my book. It's not a simple part, but I will explain what I think happened. My argument is that it was the interaction between two shifts that led to the shocks. That's why I called it The Shifts and the Shocks. A title, by the way, that I stole from some friends of mine, and I give due acknowledgement in the acknowledgements. So the first thing that I think happened, which is very surprising and still, I think, not fully understood, was that in the late 90s and early 2000s, there was a worldwide fall in real interest rates on safe assets. And the most, and I use a very simple indicator on that, I use, but I could use others. The IMF has made the same point. The indicator I use is index-linked gilts. And the indicator matters less. What matters more is the scale. The real interest rates on safe assets almost halved, from close to 4% to close to 2%. That's a massive shift in the single most important price in financial markets. And the immediate consequence of that, and you can see it almost immediately afterwards, is that in a number of very important markets, real long-term asset prices started rising above all housing. That was exactly what you'd expect. Mervyn King has discussed that. And it was an important trigger moment for the asset price boom that subsequently happened. And I'll come in a moment to how that linked with the financial sector and subsequent fragility. Obviously, a deep question is why this fall in real interest rates, which has lasted since then, has never reverted to 4%, continued until, of course, the crisis, when the real interest rate fell to zero. And we are living in long-term real rates. We're living in a world where long-term real rates on safe assets are in the territory of zero, which is a very weird world. It's a very strange world. And I'm constantly surprised how rarely people talk about it, because it is such a strange world. And the only, you know, the standard theory to explain such a phenomenon is what Bernanke called a savings glut, but basically a massive shift worldwide in income towards desired savings and away from desired investment, worldwide, globally. And I think that is indeed what happened as the driving force. This is not a monetary phenomenon. It's impossible to explain a fall in real interest rates over so long a period simply by monetary policy. I'll come to them in a moment to what role monetary policy played. I think there were basically two things happening. The first was the shift of the emerging world as a whole, initially East Asia and then the oil countries towards massive saving surpluses. So we got this very strange phenomenon of capital flowing net with a desire for safe assets, very clearly what they wanted to buy, from the emerging world into the developed world. Exactly the opposite of what most people would have expected to happen in a globalized world, which, as happened in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, would have thought, be a world in which capital would flow net from rich countries to poorer countries. But that's not what happened. It went in the opposite direction. I don't have time to discuss why, but there were clearly policy choices involved in that outcome. Decisions to intervene in asset markets, particularly exchange markets, accumulate foreign currency reserves, and so forth. And at the same time, in a number of developed countries, the US certainly being the most important, there was a shift, but it was quite general, there was a shift in internal income distribution from labor to capital and between and within labor towards capital and towards profits, therefore, which have been exceptionally high, and towards very high incomes. The profit share, I think, is probably the most significant element of this, because simultaneously after the dot-com bubble burst, investment propensities in most developed countries in the corporate sector declined. So the corporate sector of the West joined the Japanese corporate sector, which has been like that since 1990, in essentially having higher retained earnings than it invests. It's accumulating financial assets from the rest of the economy instead of importing them. This is, again, completely surprising. It's the opposite of what has been normally the case ever since we invented the corporate form, which is, by and large, corporates in aggregate import savings from the rest of the economy, basically the household sector, and invest them. But we've been doing the opposite. And those are, I think, the core saving shifts. Now, we had to find some way of balancing our economies macroeconomically in this situation. And we didn't do it deliberately, but we had rising house prices. We had lots of savings coming in from the developing world and also from the corporate sector in through their treasuries. And there had to be something on the opposite side. By definition, there has to be something on the opposite side. And there are only two possible things on the opposite side if the economy is to balance. And one is household borrowing and the other is government borrowing. And in the first round, up to 2007, it was dominated by household borrowing. And the financial sector, which had been liberalized progressively from 1980 onwards, particularly in the US, was fantastically brilliant at creating ways of channeling money to the household sector to spend much more than its income, backed essentially by the rising house prices that I've described. And so this process worked best where you had a financial sector which was designed to do that. Our financial sector had been designed to do that. The American financial sector, even more interestingly, it's a very complicated structure, was designed to do that. And so the macro balance that we achieved came with an incredibly rapid growth of credit, largely collateralized against housing and commercial property, overwhelmingly, with an amazing range of new assets invented. And then, when house prices started to peak, as they did in America in 2005 and later in Spain and other countries, the whole thing started to collapse. And we had a panic, which I've already described. This, in approximately 6 minutes, has covered three chapters of my book. And I hope it whets your appetite enough to analyze a bit, to look a bit further at my story as I've tried to tell you it. Okay, the whole thing collapsed. We were then, so what have we done since then? The whole thing collapsed. We used a range of unbelievable policies to sustain the system. I've already described the monetary policies, which were extraordinary. And remain extraordinary, crucial. We remains extraordinary. We are desperately trying to get people to spend. We had, of course, we jumped immediately when the economy collapsed into huge fiscal deficits. Overwhelming, I discussed that in the book, in all the developed countries, these huge fiscal deficits were not the consequence of deliberate fiscal policy. They were the consequence or the simply of the crisis itself, namely collapses in revenue that occurred because the housing sector collapsed, the profits of the financial sector collapsed, and these were very revenue rich. So, and we, the UK being particularly dependent on revenues associated with these two sectors, suffered from particularly massive revenue shortfalls. Nominal GDP also collapsed, really very markedly, since nominal spending was more or less given, it couldn't be changed overnight, that jumped up spending relative to GDP very, very quickly. And in an incredibly short period, we moved from, it depended on the country, modest deficits, 3% of GDP or so, or even in some cases surpluses, like Ireland and Spain. Ireland and Spain were running surpluses for years before the crisis, and their net debt was down to really low levels. Ireland's net debt was about 10% of GDP, 11% to be precise, before the crisis. Spain's was about 30%. 20%, I think. And then they shot up just because the fiscal deficits exploded. And this is exactly what Carmen Reinhart and Ken Rogoff, in their very, very important book, This Time is Different, predicted. You have these huge fiscal crises. But the fiscal policy supported the system. The government continued to spend. It ignored its revenue constraints, which is exactly what Keynes would have recommended. And that helped turn around the immensely deep recession very quickly. The financial system was backed in more ways than you can imagine, and I just can't even begin to list all the ways we backed the financial sector, but the core of it is that immense amounts of capital were injected into the banking sectors in every country, notably here, where RBS and Lloyds were rescued. RBS, by the way, it's worth remembering, at the time of the crisis, was the biggest bank in the world by assets. It is rather remarkable that that was permitted to happen. Lloyds is, of course, was basically the consequence of the forced merger with HBOS. America, of course, they put in capital too. The liabilities of the banking sector of the entire Western world were socialized, and that sentence is correct. The liabilities of the entire financial system were socialized by explicit commitment of the governments. And then after a couple of years, we began to try and normalize policy. I don't have time to go through, because of the lack of time, the Eurozone crisis, which is a very large part of my book. But it's a bit like this, but more complicated, because everything has to be agreed among all its members. And, of course, as you probably noticed, it's been a sad story of too little. Not too little. Just enough, far too late. So they are slowly getting to the right point, but at this rate it's going to take quite a number of years before they finally do, and it's incredibly difficult, but I just don't have time to go into that. Then we got to the reform process, and that's been a very, very interesting process, and I just want to summarise very briefly what I see as the core of what we've done in the reform process. I'm going to ignore the Eurozone because it's just too much for me to talk about reforms in the Eurozone within the time limits, because I want to stop in about 5 minutes. But essentially, the following things have happened. The monetary policy system that we use today is, in terms of its objectives, exactly the same as the pre-crisis monetary policy system. There has been no change in terms of its core monetary objectives. Inflation targeting 2%. That remains the case. There's been a lot of discussion of different monetary policy rules and targets, but they've all been scrapped. So there's an implication to the way I'm putting this, which I'll come to in a moment. Fiscal policy, well, everybody knows we're trying to tighten. We're tightening slowly, predominantly on spending, which is quite interesting, rather than tax increases. That's true in the US, it's true here, and it's true in most of Europe. The fiscal reconstruction is a very long-term process, and we've all suffered, to a greater or lesser extent, jumps in debt public debt. So one of the legacies is a big jump in public debt, and in some cases staggering. Ireland has moved from a net debt ratio of about 10% of GDP to 110%, one of the more spectacular rises in world history in a period of about 5 or 6 years. The financial sector has demonstrated its capacity to break states. And a lot of that, no, not all by any means, but a third of that is because they guaranteed the entire financial sector. The financial system, we have essentially the same financial system as before, but it is much more comprehensively regulated with far more comprehensive and detailed rules. In a famous paper, Andy Haldane and a co-author, which was released, which he delivered at Jackson Hole Conference, the Jackson Hole Conference 2 years ago, he said that at the rate they were going, and I haven't checked since, the American financial sector rule book will end up at more than 30,000 pages, and the European rule book would end up at 60,000 pages. And if anybody thinks they know what's in it, I suspect they are wrong. And it's remarkable because I very rarely feel sympathy for the banks, but I really don't see how they can operate in those circumstances. But in essentially, apart from that, the financial system we've ended up is the same as before, except that it's more concentrated, with the banks are more too big to fail, because so many of their competitors disappeared, or particularly smaller competitors. And we rely for managing the system, and this is the one genuine innovation, on something called macroprudential policy, which is essentially the attempt of the all-wise regulators in the Bank of England and other central banks to tweak the entire system constantly in order to avoid its blowing us all up. So we have developed an extraordinary relationship with the financial sector, which we have, as far as I can see, with only one other sector of our economy, and that's the nuclear power industry. And presumably for the same reason, we think these people have the capacity to blow us up, economically, as it were. And I think this is really a toxic relationship. It's a toxic situation we've now ended up in. Now, what should be done? I'm a controversial in the, remain controversial in that I think, and I continue to think, too much attention was paid in particularly in 2010, 11, 12, to beginning the fiscal austerity rather than making sure that we got back to very, very strong demand growth as quickly as possible to minimise the longer-term damages of the crisis. That's now history, and I have argued throughout that since government can borrow at 0% real for very long periods, really long periods, there simply will never be a better opportunity in our history for doing lots and lots of infrastructure building. We've done some, but nothing like enough, and I think future generations will regret this. That applies particularly to the US, UK, and of course to many of the Eurozone countries. There are some very big long-run questions here, and I'll just mention a couple. The first is developing and emerging countries remain utterly terrified of being net importers of capital from us. And as long as they remain terrified of this, because they associate that with crises, they will continue to manage their affairs so they export capital to us. Since the Eurozone is also busily in the business of trying to develop a large current account surplus because nobody's allowed to spend any money, that means that all the current account deficits in the world have a tendency to end up in the US and UK. And that has repercussions that for some reason the Treasury still doesn't understand, as I was trying to indicate in my comments on the autumn statement. The OBR, however, does understand it, more or less. What it means is we've got to create another great big housing bubble in our economy, and that's what we're doing. And if that makes you feel happy about where we are, then you're in a different mental state from me. But that's where that's what's happening. This is very important. And my implication of this is we really have to create a global system, and I'm sure it's what Keynes would have argued for, because it's what he did argue for, that gives developing countries that are net importer capital greater insurance against what's called sudden stops in capital flows. The sort of thing that happened within the Eurozone when capital just stopped flowing into countries like Portugal and Greece and Italy and Spain and Ireland. And on finance, my view is that we need a deal in which, by making banks more robust, which is part of what we tried to do in the ICB with ring fencing, more robust, we can reduce the sheer, and with the better internal incentives, we can reduce the scale of intrusive interventions. And to me, the simplest way of doing that, discuss it at length, there are other more radical ways, is by increasing the capital of banks. I'd like to remind you, and I've just checked this so I'm up to date, that the major British banks are now all leveraged about 25 to 1. That's the precise. Do not look at the risk-weighted capital ratios that they report. They're all based on assumptions about losses of different assets, which are almost certainly going to be proved wrong. Look at the actual leverage, and what that means very, very simply is if they lose 4% of the value of their balance sheet, they're bust. And there aren't many complex financial institutions that can promise you safely they will never lose 4% of their balance sheet. So this is a slightly, I think, a fundamental problem with the banking sector, and I discussed that at great length. Finally, let me talk about the geopolitical consequences and then close. So I'll mention five things that this crisis means, which should interest people whose main interest is not economics, but geopolitics. First, we are living, as of course you all know, because it's the great banality of our age, in a time of very rapid transition in relative economic power. Comparable to, but the reverse of, what happened in the 19th century, when the West, as we think of it now, rose from already a very substantial position of power to by 1900, a position of absolutely overwhelming economic preponderance, which probably reached its apogee about 1950. At which point, so if you take the US on the one hand and China on the other, US GDP per head at common international prices was 30 times China's. So that was that was the extreme. We're now in a very rapid period of very rapid transformation. Most of that transformation has occurred in the last 20 years. It's predominantly associated with China, but also to a significant degree with India. And this crisis accelerated that. And accelerated it so far. It's interesting to see what its final implications are for China, because we just stopped growing. And they went on growing. So obviously it accelerated this transition rather rapidly. The second effect of this, and I don't think you can easily exaggerate that, is we've had a profound loss of Western prestige and influence. I spent my first 10 years of my life working on developing countries at the World Bank, and I've spent a lot of time visiting emerging and developing countries, and I'm sure they're not that frank with me. I am a journalist, so I poke a bit. And I tend to characterize the view they had of Western countries on economic policy making before the crisis was, we really, really don't like you, and we really, really have had enough of your lessons to us, but we sort of suspect you know what you're doing. Well, I assure you they don't think the latter anymore. We have demonstrated pretty conclusively we don't. And that is a pretty deep shift, and it's particularly noticeable in China. So when we talk, they don't listen. And it's been particularly true for the US, and it will take quite a while for the US to regain this. And I'm not even talking about all the foreign policy blunders. This is another category. Third, there's a great deal of hidden resentment over unfair treatment, i.e. the Asian countries were forced to do all sorts of very unpleasant things in the late 90s because we were told that they suffered from crony capitalism and all the rest of it, and they were told to cut their fiscal deficits and raise interest rates and all the rest of it, and we didn't do any of these things, and they've noticed. So they think our business is to give them unbelievably unpalatable medicine that weakens them, and we don't do the same thing. I'm not saying they're right, that's what they think. The fourth implication of all this is that demands for rebalancing power in global institutions have risen, and will rise further, and we're doing an incredibly bad job of meeting them. And in this respect, though the US is in the doghouse over its refusal to support the latest rebalancing in the IMF, which is the most important of these international monetary institutions, the Europeans are a much bigger problem because they have a much bigger and much more unwarranted share in the votes in these institutions. And the result of that is that China essentially is going to create its own. And that's a very, very unfortunate development, which we could have avoided if we hadn't been so damn stupid. And finally, about 3 years ago, I think it was 3 years ago, maybe four, we had, it's a useful story, and it has an end, it's not very long, we had a conference in New York, and one of the panels was on geopolitics, but it was mainly about economics, and one of the participants was Joe Nye, who many of you must know and must have read. He's a good friend of mine, and I have great respect for him. And he said, he was saying that, and it was already the crisis was a couple of years old, but he said that one thing he was quite sure of is that whatever would happen, the US would never cut defense spending. And I said, you are utterly wrong. It is certain you will cut defense spending, and it is certain we will cut defense spending, because when this austerity hits, that's where it's going to go. And does anyone doubt that now? The economics, as I said, is the basis of military power, both technologically and, of course, in terms of the resources people are prepared to devote to security. And one of the results of this crisis, and I won't talk about all the other aspects, is that the money is really, really tight. And one of the most fascinating observations is that the Republicans in the US and the Conservatives in Britain have been completely comfortable with pursuing policies whose net effect is really remarkably, remarkable stringency in our defense and security spending, and that surely too will have very long-run implications. The Chinese, meanwhile, as I'm sure you all know much better than I do, are going very much in the opposite direction. So there are at least five ways, there are probably many, many more, in which this crisis has immediate practical and significant implications for the West and for Britain's foreign policy and security stance. Thank you for listening to me.